Welcome, listeners. I'm your host, Lawrence of America, and that was a crappy intro. A little bit of a stumble. I've got some new voices with me today, sitting around with me, new to the shop as of, 6 months ago or so?
5 months.
I mean, as far as being employed. But, long time, customer.
Hi, I'm Travis.
And also another long-time customer, first time to the podcast.
Hi, it's Robert.
And notably missing would be Gomer, the irredeemable Gomer, Angry Taylor, and Adam Normal, and Jules True. Jules True backed out because something about family obligations. Angry Taylor... He wanted to go see some Star Wars movie. I don't know.
Something
I heard
big
something
one that came out today, maybe.
Yeah, yes. I mean, I heard something about Space Knights or whatever. You know, samurais in space.
Something along those lines.
Laser swords, no.
Blowing up innocent contractors or whatever. intergalactic terrorists, whatever. And Gomer, of course. He hasn't made it in quite the past few podcasts due to family situations, being a screaming small diaper clad family situations.
Kids are the worst. I mean, not really. I mean,
as far as for your toys and hobbies, they are.
But they're the best, like when you're just at home with them and they're looking at you and you're looking at them and they're all cute and assuming they look like you. If they look like the neighbor, not so much.
Yeah, that could get you into some trouble.
Well, Adam Normal may or may not be able to join us. He said he is stuck in traffic right now, and he may hop in at some point in time. But we were just talking about role-playing games, how we've all played a bunch of different role-playing games. And, I've been playing since I was a wee teen, and I know Travis has been playing, Robert's also. We've all... probably been playing for 20 plus years.
Yep.
Oh yeah. So we've all played multiple systems, and somebody had mentioned one of the Star Wars. You were saying you really like the Star Wars system.
I do. It is very balanced compared to a lot of the systems out there.
And you were talking about Advantage Force or something. I know it has a very weird dice system. Is what started out this conversation. And they'll have 12-sided dice, 8-sided dice, 10-sided dice, D6s.
It's got a 6-sided dice. It has a...
But they're not numbers. They're
symbols.
Jedi symbols and an explosion and stuff like that. Yeah.
It's a very much, for every dice you roll... there's a counter dice roll. So you can roll 20 dice between you and the DM, and it can come out a complete wash. You can fail to do what you were trying, but still get some sort of advantage. Or the enemy can succeed or get an advantage against you if you fail and he succeeds.
So
it takes getting used to.
You're saying something about it being not very friendly to the min-maxers, power. Now.
I'm sure there are min-maxers out there that can sit down and, after a couple of hours of study, find a loophole. But just looking at it right off the open, there's not an easy way, in my opinion, to do it.
I was listening to you describe it, so I'm looking at the symbols. I'm trying to figure out, if they're not numbers, are they describing effects? And if so, does that narrow the resolution? Like, the symbol represents a specific outcome?
Yes, the symbols represent successes.
Okay.
And advantages. Or failures and disadvantages.
And so, are those defined by rules or by the GM and the player, like on the spot? The GM says, you have advantage, and that advantage is, and they just describe what they could.
The advantages, they give examples.
Okay.
In the book, with correlating activities.
Okay.
Of what you're trying to do. But, of course, the hallmark of a good GM is someone who can kind of think on the fly.
Right.
And just come up with
okay
what you're looking for. It definitely like I said, it takes a little bit of getting used to, because you're rolling dice equal to skill and attribute, and then the GM puts a difficulty rating in it. So then you add in, you know, the negative dice,
right,
that we were talking about, because they're all color coordinated. Then your negative dice are black and red. Your positive dice are yellow, purple, and green. And then the light blue dice are dice that you can save up. If you did something and it helps me out by you doing it, I can get one of those light blue dice and set aside to roll on my next action.
Okay, I got you. Like a bonus die.
Like a bonus die.
Okay, I got you. I was just thinking, like, when you talk about these advantages, and I cannot remember the exact name, but somebody went to Gen Con, Dragon Con, and came back with this game we played a few years ago. I think it was called Spectre, but the premise is it was essentially Ghostbusters. Okay?
Hmm.
And one of the rules of that game was near successes and near failures. So if you had a difficulty success rate, you had to get, you know, 5 or whatever. If you were within a certain band of it, let's say you were just under it, it would, this check would fail, but you would get some benefit, and that was up to the GM. Or if you were just over it, it would succeed mostly, but there'd be some disadvantage. And the idea is, like, let's say you were trying to, say, stealth across this doorway. If you just barely succeeded, you may get all the way to the door before you get heard. Or, you know, you trying to wrestle somebody, you pin the guy, but they have their gun arm free. And likewise, if you fail, you know, you don't do whatever you're doing, but something happens that benefits you. And I thought that was very interesting, to allow the GM and the player to kind of come up with this mediocre success or failure.
And it's very much similar,
okay,
to that. You know, the prime example I always use, I'm firing my blaster at somebody. I don't hit them, but the blaster fire keeps them pinned down, so they don't get a shot back at me.
Right, exactly.
Like I said earlier, one of the things I really like about the game is the ways you can play it, and the fact that when I played it, we did Outer Rim, and we used all the Outer Rim books, so we were just smugglers. There was no Jedi involved. We were just trying to make a life and avoid the Empire. You can do it during the Rebellion itself. They have core rule books for that.
For Age of Rebellion.
And then they have a Force book.
Empire. And, okay. You know, which makes me wonder, you know, are they going to do a core book, say, you know, about more military soldiers or whatever, special forces type, you know?
It's definitely a possibility. I'm only really familiar with the main rule book. Okay. They have done some expansion books, but I don't know exactly what all. Especially, I would imagine you would get a lot more of your Stormtrooper and Rebellion Special Ops in the Age of Rebellion book series, because we only did the Outer Rim.
Yeah, and I guess the Age of Rebellion after that would be like a civil war that they're leading up to with, you know,
right,
8 and 9, I suppose.
Yeah.
Now, here's the thing. Does it include space combat rules for the RPG as well?
Yes.
Okay, and they use the same dice?
Same dice.
Okay.
Yep. Everything.
For like the X-Wing TIE fighter type dogfighting?
Yep.
Okay.
Yeah, because once again, it comes down to, like, if you have a pilot skill, mm-hmm, you've got to do space pilot, land pilot.
Right.
So I can know how to, you know, pilot a tracked vehicle or a little skimmer, but I may not know how to pilot a spaceship.
Right.
I mean, legitimately, do you use the term pilot when it comes to a tractable land vehicle?
You know, that's a gaming convention, of course, right? Yeah. They try to keep it simple.
Like, really, if it's on water, you usually, what, captain a vehicle?
Yeah.
I mean,
crew, I don't know. I don't know. And that is the thing. I think in the effort to streamline the rules and the terminology, pilot is probably the best way, you know.
Well, I guess...
We live in the real world where, you know, like, you drive cars.
If they expect you to fly more, right, you know, or pilot more than you would actually drive, yeah, I guess I could see that. But
what I'm interested, I guess, to me, it's hard to see how. I've seen very few games that can do that effectively, where they combine good rules for vehicle-to-vehicle combat in with person-to-person combat, and it seems that the same rule set applies. And I really think that's difficult for space combat being more three-dimensional and usually longer range and higher speed. I've never been satisfied to say, like, okay, the same rules that go for combat within the space of a dwelling are also make sense and give me the same sense when I'm up in space and I can go in every direction, you know, sublight speed, but, you know, really fast.
Right.
You know, does it really work, or is it just...
You know, I didn't really have a problem with it.
Okay.
And part of that, too, also comes down to the storyteller.
Okay, sure.
You know, with all role-playing games,
it comes down to who's telling it. Good storyteller, good DM, game master, whatever. I always refer to it as DM.
Yeah.
You know, because let's face it, D&D is pretty much the one that started it all.
Yeah, true.
I mean... And I know some nerd out there is like, no, there were 14 other systems before that. And don't get me wrong, I understand that. But it's the one that made it into the mainstream knowledge or awareness or whatever. And you were saying something earlier that you'd played so many. It's hard to sell you on a new system.
It really is, in the sense that, I'll tell you, for example, we played Dungeons and Dragons 3rd edition and in 3.5, and 4E came out, buddy of ours got the book, and I mean, I remember he wrote literally a review, and I think he had 10 points as to why 4E was better, trying to convince us to buy all new books, which I know you have a store, you want to encourage people to do the same thing. But we were like, we know these rules, we like them, we're comfortable with them, what does it really add that we don't have here?
Well, 4th edition, to me, never would have made it. And, well, it never caught on with people that liked 3rd edition. It was a fundamentally different game. Yeah. It was closer to board game-esque rules than it was, you know, RPGs. You know, just storytelling, you know.
Sure.
If storytelling is a 10 and Monopoly is a 1, you know, 3.5 may be, you know, a 6 or a 7, you know. And I think that was more of a 3 or a 4.
Sure.
You know.
But our objection wasn't just that we didn't like that rule system. It was, why should we change to any new system, is what I was getting at. And I was like, that's the question. Once you find a system that you're comfortable with, if you're an experienced gamer, I can adapt into any whatever new thing is there. We could adapt that into this, and without throwing out whatever we already know.
Well,
and it just depends. Sometimes you can't. But that was most of our group's feeling was, what does this add that we can't just add into our game?
All right, so
without scrapping the baseline.
Here's the problem with 4th edition was corporation. All right, so. You look at TSR,
sure.
Company back now. TSR, for those of you who are currently in your teens, may not have ever heard the name TSR.
I miss TSR.
TSR, they are the original publishers of D&D. Now, when they were bought up because they were failing, because the problem, like you said, is, why should we buy another rule set? So TSR's main income was selling supplements or expanded worlds.
And they had a ton of them.
And they never came out. People didn't need it. People made up their own worlds. It was all, you could buy that stuff, but you didn't need it. The rules were, they got pretty complicated if you went with the advanced. Yeah, a second edition, advanced edition. I should say advanced second edition.
THACO.
Yeah. So the Adventure Quest, they'd come out and they'd sell, but it was a small market. So Wizards of the Coast, they hit it big with Magic, looking to diversify into other products. Now that they've had these inroads with all these stores and marketers, all these hobby games know about them, they bought up TSR. And that made them, the for a little while, the largest American game company because of the value of that brand and the value of Magic, which immediately caused a takeover, you know, or like within a year caused a takeover by Hasbro.
Right.
Which was the beforehand the current, and for many, many years. So what happened when Wizards of the Coast bought TSR? They looked at D&D, its biggest brand, and they're like, okay, this is complicated. We need to keep the complexity while streamlining it. It has had character upgrades and rules, so they took a rough draft, and that came out third edition.
Right.
And for the most part, anybody who played second edition, new second edition, it was a fairly easy switch,
mm-hmm.
you know, because it was a more streamlined version. And they put out some patches and some updates, you know, and they started revamping some things. You know, so Hasbro buys them out, and they're like, okay, well, you know, all right, crank out some more Magic. Crank out some more D&D. We need to recoup our money back. They're like, well, we just put out a version of D&D like a year or two ago. So, put out another set of books. And they begin working on an upgraded, you know, version 3.5. And that really wasn't a new version. That was kind of like a half version.
Right, as the name.
you know, so it really...
Like, I don't think I ever got a 3.5 DM.
Right. I mean, there was hardly no difference.
A PDF that gave you everything you needed between the two books.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they got that out there, and it was just mainly updated art, updated stats, stuff they'd... it included all the rules from the expansions,
right.
you know, where they've updated the characters and stuff like that. You know, it was kind of just a simple patch, but when they put out 4th, it was a whole new system.
Sure.
You know, it was basically, you know, when they redesign a computer's AI engine, you know, or video game AI engine, whole new engine, operate it, you had to relearn.
Yes.
But it was marketed at a World of Warcraft type audience, a video game audience, and that wasn't the RPG audience.
But I think that there were, and I hear that analogy a lot. And I remember reading thoroughly these books and reading articles about reviewing it. Like, so my friend, he wrote this 10-point, and I starting from that, I think that, I guess what I'm saying is, at the time, I felt that that was almost like a derogatory comment. Like, oh, this isn't really for gamers, role-playing gamers. This is for video gamers, as if they were less or expected less. And even though I do feel that I think there was a target audience they were shifting toward, I just feel that same kind of like, well, let's not say that, you know, so bluntly. I think they're trying to expand the audience. And I think what they were doing was they recognized that something they Wizards mentioned with Magic the Gathering. There's a barrier to entry. You know, and that's why they went to the New World Order with Magic cards of saying, we want to make sure when you get into Magic and you just start playing, it's simple to get in. It's not so hard and complex. I really think that if you looked at all the splat books that were out for 3.5, and you start talking to gamers about 3.5, you couldn't connect to it easily.
There were too many books.
Right. Whereas if you came into 4E, it was so much more, it was less barriers to entry so more people can get into it. And I think they were trying to say, and there's a gamer crowd out there who we can maybe try to cross-pollinate, video gamers. But I don't think it was, I think sometimes I get this sense that marketing it to the World of Warcraft audience was almost like we were dumbing the game down.
Well, in a sense, they were. And my big issue, when I say it was more like a board game, is they're like, we need to sell more. We need to sell more add-ons. And the first versions of the 4.0, they were like, yep, if you don't have miniatures, you're not playing real D&D.
Yeah.
And that made a lot of people mad.
Mm-hmm. I've never played D&D with miniatures, or yeah. most of the role-playing games that I've played.
And, you know, like, I've used miniatures during combat, or at least when I say miniatures, like, okay, So the goblin is the thimble, you know.
Right.
You're the purple, the pawn, whatever. And this is here.
The only miniatures that matched were the ones that people got for their own characters. My character looked like my character, and I may have painted some of them. Everything else was whatever I called it.
Yeah, so, yeah. Like, we have one of our DMs who's notorious for using candy for monsters.
Yep.
That's the in-game kill reward system. And I thought that was genius.
I thought it was beautiful, a good idea. When you kill it, you eat it.
Yeah. That, and the other big notice that it went from, this has a range of attack of 5 feet. You know, it's a 5 foot wide cone, or you can see 50 feet, or, you know, this arrow can shoot 100 yards to, you can shoot 10 squares, or, you know, it has a three square cone, you know, and it's like.
But they wanted you to use the mats and the minis.
Right.
Although, to be fair, everyone knew that a square was 5 feet.
Right, and they did say that.
Right.
You know, but. I played a little 3.5, mm-hmm. but I skipped mainly from 2nd edition to 4th edition.
Oh, wow.
And see, I dropped the 3.5.
No, like, I went out and I'm like, you know what? I've got all these 2nd edition books. I sold all my 2nd edition core books.
Right.
You know, and all that stuff when they went out of print. Because they went out of print for a long time. You can get them all now in PDF or whatever, but for a while, the only way to actually get the books was to hunt them down.
Right.
And, you know, so I had all the core books, and I sold those for a couple $100. And I went out, and I'm like, you know what? I'm going to try this new system, and dropped $150 on the deluxe slipcover collector's edition. Got it. Went home, read the DM, and I'm like, what the f*** is this shit? And put it back, and I went, and I came back up to the store, and I'm like, hey, Mark, this is some shit. Here, can you sell this on consignment if somebody wants it? And he looked at it, and he said, yeah. So he marked it down, you know, because it had been shrink-wrap removed, but it was practically brand new. And, you know, because I bought it, and I didn't want to, like, totally stiff him and be like, hey, I need my money back. This is a bad product. Because, no, it was exactly what it said it was. You know, it wasn't his fault.
Right.
But he gave me a partial refund, and somebody else that wanted to try it didn't bite the bullet on the whole thing. Yeah. So, you know, and I ended up spending the money here anyway.
Right.
You know, and that was, you know, I didn't look it for. Now, then we run D&D games here every night. And once I started working here several years later, they were short. They had two players for D&D game, and they needed a third. And I'm like, fine. I took one of the pre-gen characters, jumped into 5th edition, and 5th edition was what I loved about D&D. It was intuitive. It was simple. I could jump in and play. I was playing a pre-gen character. It was the closest I'd ever played a version to that old red box.
Right.
The old basic D&D, the one where you could just jump in and go and have some fun. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. You know, I thought the advantage-disadvantage system was nice. It was good. And eventually they got so many players that I just bowed out. But, I of course had real fun with the character. You know, it was the pre-gen, like, noble character. So I just made him this super conceited asshole who thought he was better than everything. And the scale of, you know, of who was best, it was peasants, you, his servant, his horse, his axe, and then him. That was how he said. You know, and I played him with that, and she was like, it's not your fault that you're a lesser person. It's just the way it is.
Yeah.
Sorry. So, and it was a really fun character that all the other characters hated me, but I was the tank, so.
Well, and I think that's one of the great things about role-playing is character concept. Yeah. Is really coming up with your own style for each individual character that you play.
And I think that's what transcends system and even edition. Like I said, you know, it's not just that 4E was worse than 3.5, or 5 is better than both, which I think it is in that order. I think 4E is worse than 3.5, and 5 is better than 5 is better than 3.5. But what the system should do is it should not hinder role-playing. Being the character and being able to immerse yourself in the action and adventure. I think whenever, the way I was taught the most, my first GM said, how effective your character is 15% what's on your character sheet, 85% the way you play the character.
Oh, yeah, I'd agree with that.
And so to me, what I want is I want a system that doesn't bog me down in the rules and the mechanics so that I get out of being my character. I want to feel like I'm doing what my character would do and that still be effective, as opposed to trying to have to adjust to the system.
Which I think that was one of my biggest problems with the hero system.
Okay.
Was you'd spend 3 hours just trying to get through character creation.
And character creation in different games, that can be a barrier too, I think, because what happens is if you have a system, and especially if there's a pattern like of your group, that encourages you to build a character into a build, into an effectiveness, it can get away from trying to be the character.
Right.
Because you're saying, well, I want my character sheet, my stats and mechanics and abilities, to be effective in the action sequences. So now I have things like dump stats, where I'm not going to give my character high intelligence because that's not helpful in any way. But I think of my guy as a smart guy, but the best stat I could put there was a 12.
Right. You
know? And that's kind of average. And that kind of defeats the idea of, no, I really wanted to play this guy who was smart. And you have but if that isn't effective in the game, then you don't want to do that.
Well, and that's what I was saying earlier. Vampire the Masquerade, the White Wolf system.
Sure.
Always felt the best for creating a character because you didn't roll dice to get stats or whatever. Just spent so many points. Mm-hmm. And as far as you're like, I want this skill to be more, I want to have this skill and that skill. So it seemed like it was the best one for role playing.
Right.
Right. Vampire was very much a storytelling system compared to a dungeon crawl.
And I definitely enjoyed that. Because really, I mean, that's a large portion of role-playing games to me is the storytelling, and that's what I always enjoy.
I agree. I think the systems, like I said, the GM makes the difference. If you
really
trust
does.
Your GM and you can let go of trying to be a rules lawyer, if the GM says, hey, however they come up with it, they say you need a 14 and you roll the 14 and it works, just go with that. It shouldn't really matter whether they plucked that number out of their behind or whether it was the result of all the different calculations of advantage, disadvantage, skills, and the other. However that number comes up, if you trust your GM and it moves the actions forward and it moves the story forward, you should just roll with it.
Really, because a good GM's going to end up having to lie on those numbers. because if you just play it hardcore by the books, especially in the old second edition D&D days, you were probably going to die.
Oh, yeah.
Especially in Shadowrun. Shadowrun was perhaps the most lethal combat system I've ever played in.
It said in the rulebook, don't get attached to your characters because they will die. But Shadowrun is one of my favorites just because of how easy the system is.
And it definitely has a cult following.
Right. Now, again, I'm thinking about this. If you're a new player, those who are listening, you don't have this wealth of experience we're talking about. We're all talking about how we have 25, 30 years gaming experience. You're not. You're going to come into this group. You're 17 years old. Your buddies are 16 or 17. And, you know, you don't trust each other. You're very hyper-competitive because you're probably young teenage boys. Okay? So, yes, you feel like sometimes your GM is trying to beat you. You swing your axe and you miss, or your character gets killed. Sometimes you'll take that personally. So yes, I think when you start off, you do sometimes need a rule.
For those kind of gamers that really, when the because sometimes the DM does want to beat you.
Yes.
And that's when you need to play games like Descent. That's why I think Descent is a dungeon crawl game.
Right.
It to me is one step down from 4th edition, but. But it is a a board game. It's all about the miniatures or whatever. One guy now, and the fun thing about that one, they do have an app that can DM it for you.
Okay.
But one person can play the storyteller or game master, whatever they call it. And if you have a, you know, a tablet or whatever, or a computer, you can run this app, and it can tell you set up the spaces here, and you can enter the your number, what you roll, attack this monster, you know, right. Whatever. Yeah, but it can tell the story for you. But normally it's one side, one guy playing all the bad guys, and each person playing a hero.
Right.
You know, and you go through these dungeon adventure. You know, and it's a Fantasy Flight game. So, you know, and it's a fun game, and it's designed to be a campaign game or whatever.
Right.
And it's that game, it's okay if you lose, quote unquote, you know, but there is a win-loss, you know. It's just, okay, you're going into this dungeon. Boom, fight, you know.
And I think when you first start role-playing, it is... I mean, well, I'll say this. I don't play computer video games now and RPGs, so they probably have expanded better. But my experience was role-playing games were so much better than the very limited, narrow-scope video games that were out when I was a kid. Now that those worlds are merging because of advanced AI and programs we can do, you probably don't need as much transition. But I think, yes, you transition from, oh, I can just do whatever I want, and that's the new unique thing about role-playing games, that there's not a map I have to follow. There's not... I don't have to talk to the townsperson. They give me the one clue, and it leads me to the next plot point. I can do whatever. That, I think, is the great thing about role-playing games. And I think once you get used to having that freedom and you can release the notion of winning, you can then move into now. It almost is like a Second Life or a Sims thing where you can just be this person.
These open sandbox-type games that... You know, they've been trying to develop for so long, and that gaming experience has been there all along in tabletop gaming. You're
exactly.
definitely right.
But you do have to, I think you have to build up to it as a gamer. You know, the first time you sit down to a role-playing game, you're going to do more ROLL role-playing, dice rolling, combat, figuring that out, until you eventually get into the ROLE role-playing, which is more theater with rules.
Yeah. I'll agree with that.
And that's what I was saying. That's why shifting systems, whatever the new system is, isn't as important to me if the system can support the action.
The mechanics.
Yeah.
Going back up a little bit with the storytelling aspect of it, a buddy of mine puts it best. If you're especially, same advice I give to people when they come into the store now and they're going to DM a game for the right. first time. Come up with a beginning. Come up with an end. Let your players fill in the middle.
Well,
keep them on task from time to time. Nudge them back in the right direction you want them to go in. But let them tell their story.
Essentially, you know, my DM experience comes to find you have to all but say, here's the hand of God grabs you and puts you on your path, shakes his finger and tells you to go forth and kill the wizard. You know, and without literally saying that, you've got to... It's like working with a bad boss.
Mm.
You've got to convince them, or not. I wouldn't say bad boss, but let's say in the corporate world, you've got to convince the corporation it was their idea all along,
right?
And it's the same type of skill, you know. So, well, this got to be this is not what I want to do. This is what you want me to do,
right.
You know. And you've got to convince the players that this is what they want to do. And it's weird, but you know, you've got to have various side random encounters and everything. But if you have an A to B type path, they're not going to follow it. Period.
Nope, not at all.
And that's just the way it is. It's they're going to be like, well, we're on the Titanic. Let's see if we can swim to the bottom. You don't want to look into the lifeboats? Nah, lifeboats sound boring.
Yeah, and see, that's the joy of role playing is that you get to make that choice, and if your GM doesn't allow you to, that takes away from the fun. Like, I thought I could do what I wanted, and you're gonna drag me by the nose. One of my early GMs said, this was his analogy. He says, role playing games are about liberty, so you get to vote, but I get to choose the candidates. And so the idea is that he kind of frames a story so that you have some decision making to make, but that's limited so he knows where it's going to go. And I think that's probably a good stage to get to is like a mid-level experienced
GM. Right, because you are dragging the characters by the nose, but they don't know it now. I mean, you are teasing them and baiting them. Oh, your character wants his treasures. Well, here's these rumors or whatever. Right. You know, I mean, learning how to do that, to redirect characters, is probably a very key component to becoming a better DM.
Oh, yeah. And not losing your cool at the same time while trying to do it and getting frustrated.
This was the next level that I tried to get to, which is I'm the GM. Assuming I'm well prepared or, you know, once you're really experienced, I can do whatever. So it is easier for the GM to adapt the game to the player's desires than to try to adapt the players to the GM's desires. Because I can, you know, if you say, I want to go, you know, I'm thinking the town, the adventure will take place in a castle in the mountains. They say, we're not going to go to the castle. We're going to go to the swamp. Okay, you don't know that when you go in the swamp, I'm not using the map of the castle, and I'm just describing everything as cave walls as opposed to castle walls. You know? Maybe in the castle it was a zombie of a knight in armor because he was a man at arms. Now in the cave, I just say, okay, it's a zombie still, but now it's a dungeon delver. You know, the way they're attired. And it's easier for me to adjust that. I'm still using the exact same map, the exact same encounters, but I just put the window dressing that now it's in a cave in a swamp as opposed to a castle.
That's definitely a good point, yeah.
And they don't know the difference.
Nope.
And a lot of times, you have so many random encounters, you're going to get them lured off in some adventure when the whole time is for to have them robbed in a random encounter just to bait them to try and get their magical weapons back or whatever, right. Or for them to wake up in a jail cell or something, And now, of course, there is always the classic, you wake up with amnesia in the middle of a dungeon. What do you do now? And that's the old hokey starting campaign. Or was that you're drinking in the tavern and somebody asked for some adventurers, Yeah, so there's definitely a few classic tropes, of how we start campaigns. And
when you do, you use them. Why? Because you need to focus more on other things, I think. I think if you're a new GM, your focus should be on knowing the rules, knowing your players, learning about their characters, things like that. So you don't need to focus on how do I make this the most interesting intro scene to get them started. Because what people came to do is to roleplay their characters. So, yes, give them the trope. You're in the tavern. The old guy says, hey, you're going on this mission. Everybody nod your head and agree, okay, we're going off. And start the game. I think when you are more experienced and you know your group, they know their characters, then you can then say, okay, and one point, you know the rules, and you've got that accomplished. You can start to say, okay, now how do I really structure this so that my players, like you said, they are making their own decisions or they feel like they're making their own decisions to move through this. But I think one of the mistakes you can make as an early GM is trying to be too good too fast. Just start off with the basics. Take it easy. No one if you're a new GM, no one's expecting a lot out of you. And what you really want to do is just get into it. Get into the fun of it.
And the overall story, any story is brought to life with details,
Sure.
Some like the little things like filling in the gap, maybe describing one character they meet at the bar happened to be working for the bad guy or something. Right. And you notice this weird, grimy-looking character in a royal purple cloak and has this oddly tattered. And then later, making little notes of, you gave him a little teaser about this or that, even if you don't use it, but being able to bring some of that stuff back later, that really adds to the oh-my-God factor a lot of the players have. I always think that's a good idea.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think part of that is, as a GM, I'm going to sound nerdy, but I'm on a podcast about role-playing games. You have to, I feel
You're
like...
podcast called Geeks of the Square Table.
I know, right? So
it's okay.
You can I feel like you. Well, this is what I do is I role play into my NPCs. I imagine what are they doing, and I flesh them out as much as I would if I were playing my player character as a player. And I try to get into their mind. I try to get into my principal NPC's mind. And I got to see, you know, what is their personality? How are they? I know what the player characters are. So how are they going to deal with your, you know, arrogant noble who's too much of a... And I start imagining, okay, I know how Larry's going to do this. What happens if they meet in a bar? And I kind of map that out in my head of what that interaction would be. And I kind of can foresee that. I think when you do that, when you flesh out your world, with a backstory and things like that, that's what really makes it real for you as a GM. And when you have that, it's real for your players if you bother to describe that. But well, you've got to see it as more than just fantasy blank.
You know, a lot of people think that you have to do so much prep. You've got to have this entire backstory fleshed out and everything. And you don't have to have it all from day one. You don't have to know the history of every NPC from day one.
No, that should be very organic.
They're in the bar. They killed the barkeep because they just wanted his money and didn't want to pay their tab. Maybe later on you learn the barkeep had a cousin or something, you know? But yeah, I mean, you never want to seem unprepared, but you don't have to be prepared. So it's almost like practice your improv skills, sure. You know?
And what I mean by that is not have it written out and it's stuck in stone, but I think, like, I imagine my world when I'm not role-playing. Sometimes, you know, when you're prepping your game, you're spending time writing down monster stats and doing numbers and looking at things like that. You're drawing maps or whatever you're doing. I think you have to spend some time, half, quarter, however much, sometime just being in character, just thinking. It's like spend some time just in thought. That's not detail-oriented writing in detail about the specifics of the prep like that, but just saying, okay, you know, my this is a at the time period setting of my game, it's a war, and it's a really tough war. So when I think about my peasants, they are going to be more frightened, and they've lost loved ones, and soldiers have come through and burned the town down and stole the crop. You know, so that's a different peasant. Than your standard, it's peaceful time, we're having a nice harvest. And I think taking the time to think about that and kind of get into that setting enables you to get across the details that make it come to life. So you've got to spend some time just in your setting yourself so you can see the details in your head so that you can then describe them. So you know, well, why is this guy, why is he grimy looking in his, he's got a dingy purple cloak as opposed to it's a, you know, there's a reason behind that. And part of that comes from you're in that world and you know what happened.
Well, and I think kind of what you were saying there, a friend of mine for our Shadowrun game, mm-hmm. all of the NPCs who later turned out to be the villains were all of his former characters from previous games. So he knew exactly how these characters were going to think, they were going to act.
Oh, yeah, that's a good way to do it. Like I had a recurring character type. I did a lot of superhero role playing, and so Henry Peter Gyrick from Marvel, essentially the government guy who's in charge of the tracking and running the superhero program. You know, the government watching the superheroes. I'm sure there've been several in the different comic companies, like John Lynch in early Image with International Operations. I don't know who does it in. Is it a Waller in DC? She runs a Suicide Squad.
Yeah, Amanda Waller.
Amanda Waller. But there's always like this yeah. The government guy who works for the government and the shadowy organization has to keep track of the superheroes and supervillains. That guy was Burke in all of my superhero campaigns. And there was always whatever I named him, but he, you know, usually he was called Burke. And I had him as a stock character. He was my Amanda Waller, my Henry Peter Gyrick. So whenever he came along, I knew who he was and how he acted. He was kind of...
Well, I know I played in a few different vampire campaigns, and my favorite characters to play were Malkavians or Bruja.
Okay.
And, you know, and the Mulcahyans were the crazy clan, you know, so they could, you could get away with just about anything. And the Brujas were the Anarchs. Okay. And so you could also, you could get away with doing anything. So it was, it's really neat. My favorite character was the Mulcahyan who didn't know he was a vampire, or at least not all of his personalities did. So I had a list of personalities that were other people.
Cool.
You know, some of them fictional characters, some of them just random people. And so, like, whenever, you know, certain things would happen, he would switch characters, and I'd roll a die. Okay, now my guy thinks he's Captain Kirk. Or, now my guy thinks he's Mr. T. Or, now my guy knows he's a vampire, and, you know, he can fight and use his skills. Or, now he thinks he's an assassin, or a 12-year-old girl, or whatever. And it was a real fun character to play. Sure.
Now, could you imagine them trying to play a character like that in your first year of role-playing? Because there's so many trying to be...
Oh, no, no. Yeah. Yeah, and it was just all these off the wall. And, of course, now, you know, in my D&D campaigns, I almost always played the thief or the rogue just because it was always the chaotic neutral type character, you know, or... maybe a little lawful neutral, but usually I was the guy who would slip the DM notes. While everybody's asleep, I want to do this, you know. And then we'd get into the battle, and so I'd reach for a dagger or sword or a potion ingredient, and it just wouldn't be there, you know.
That always seems to be the thing, is that they starts off with the rogue character type doing that. The thief, the rogue character type. I find that I take that mentality into other characters. Like, for example, I made a ranger, I think it was. It may have been 3.5, who I just decided had an aversion to magic, which is just awful in a D&D campaign. But he has just decided, I'm not going to use magic weapons and items. And that was hard, but I had to go different. And I think that sometimes that playing... Like I said, I think that's when you get into playing the character, and it's not just waiting for moving from combat to combat, adventure to adventure. Outside of whatever the plot was, you were doing other things.
Right, and of course, my thief or rogue character, you know, being that jokester and the problem causer.
Right,
it would be like so and so doesn't have it, but it got planted on party B over here, you know. So,
and so, like, I remember also. I made I think it was in the 4E game I played. I had a pre-generated character. I just decided that his personality would be cantankerous, I guess, so to speak. He just was objectionable to most of the people in the party. But he was dutifully loyal to the noble who sent them on the mission. And everything he was doing was devoted toward that in his own sneaky kind of way. And he actually was a... he was a spellcaster, but I played him with that rogue mentality of, I'm with the people in the party, but maybe not with, you know, I'm with them, but not of them. And I just decided that, you know, he felt that he wasn't loyal to the group, he was loyal to their common lord. That created problems, but, you know, we got over that. To me, that created the game. And it made my character more than just this stock.
Yeah, and in reality, you're not going to find seven people that get along all the time, whatever, you know. That's so. While those kind of interactions are rough on the new DM, it's actually part of the way the players test their role playing chops a little.
Yeah, and there's always a tension about having PvP, and people who play video games say the same thing, you know, that people don't like that. Because if you're playing your characters, you have the assassin in the same party with the paladin, and eventually somebody wants to stop somebody from doing exactly what their role is. Or you have two people of opposite alignment, or they worship two different gods, or whatever it is, you know, the Batman versus Superman is going to happen in a role-playing game at some point. And that's hard to deal with because you've got to keep it friendly. Nobody wants to back down. Everybody wants to hide behind the notion of I'm playing my character, so I'm just, I don't have a choice in this because my alignment says this or my God said that. And I really think you've got to use those as tools and say, but remember, it's a group effort to have fun tonight.
Right.
And you've got to have the conflict in a way, but you've also got to resolve the conflict.
Right. You know? I was never out to destroy the party.
Sure.
Just always, you know, that was just my characters always tend to be pranksters of sorts.
But when you steal from the paladin and he has a problem with crime and he decides, well, I have to kill you now to punish you for your offense, or when someone didn't have the potion of healing they needed and the mission goes awry. You see what I'm saying? Like, even if you don't intend to, I think sometimes those PvP things can come to that head. And I've had many players say, my character, I have no choice. My character makes me do this. My alignment makes me do this. And
right,
you've got to plan, allow for PvP, but you've got to allow for a way to resolve it so we're still going to be a part of it.
I would never dare do anything like that with a new group.
Okay.
Yeah, you always do it. So far, yeah, it's with a group of experienced role players. Like, if I'm playing, like I said, where I jumped in and I played the noble that thought he was better, that was like way too great in what I thought a realistic type character that would cause a little bit of tension in the party without, you know, totally screwing up the group dynamic for new players.
Right.
You know, the like planning stuff on other players and stuff, that's for a party that's definitely been, you know, of people, players who have some experience and whatever, you know, and are used to characters dying and used to this and that, you know. And you as a player got to know what kind of group you're getting into, you know. And that, and I definitely think that thing, that is, part of the reason, you know, people have trouble finding the right mesh of people and everything, you know.
It is. It does.
Because there is a certain skill to being a role player as just party member and, you know, and knowing, feeling the party's got to come together to a certain point, you know. And you got to think, if you were at a new job, you wouldn't pull crazy stunts the first day because then you'd probably get fired. You know, but you might do something later on down the road once you knew your co-workers and stuff like that. It would be the same way with NPCs and characters mixing later on down the road. But, you know, of course, usually most of my role-playing games were all the same group of people, different systems, and year after year, you know, you know, characters come, go, whatever, you know. And those groups are hard to find.
Yeah.
I
think I've been in the same group for 15 years now.
Well, that's good. It's good. It's solid.
Yeah. But you were also saying something, you know, other than the role-playing stuff, you were saying something about a Savage World game or something?
Savage World, yeah. This was the latest one that we tried. It was great because the core book for the game is only $10. And you can run any kind of concept that you want. We did a Indiana Jones style game set with a little bit of magical elements, King Arthurian legend thrown in. It's your basic D20 system for the most part.
Mm-hmm.
Just similar to D&D, but it was quick. It was easy to learn. I was a little afraid, you know, thinking it's a tiny book, doesn't seem too complicated. How well in depth is this going to be? And it turned out, of course, always comes back to the person running the game. But it was fantastic. We're actually going to use it to do some other things because you can do sci-fi out of it, weird war type stuff.
Yeah, and I always think if the rules are getting becoming a hindrance of the gameplay, then the rules need to get out of the way. And I think that, because I remember reading the line in D&D was, you know, the golden rule is to always have fun. If a rule, you know, prevents you from having fun or prevents the game from being fun, feel free to change it. And that was one of Gary Gygax's big thing was that, you know, the game is more important than the rules.
I think what I look for in a rule set, like I said, is does it help push the action? One of my players We played 3.5 D&D, and I also ran a superhero campaign using the old Marvel superhero systems, the TSR book, where they had the universal chart on the back of the soft cover books, and you just used percentile dice. Because it only used percentile dice and there was kind of a chart for resolution of action, the system was really simple. My GM, or one of our players, they liked that so much that he made us translate our Dungeons & Dragons characters into Marvel superhero characters, and we ran a fantasy game using the Marvel superhero resolution system. Now, because we were all familiar with it, it flowed just sound. When I think about those adventures, I don't know which adventures we played with which system. And that's just how I don't ever think of an adventure back about, oh, remember I had the +5 sword and did this? I think about, well, my character was doing this then. I remember the storyline and the action. And I can't tell you now when we transitioned from one system to the other. But it was really cool that we did that because he felt that system was simpler and moved combat faster than we were talking about earlier about one of the holdups of 3.5, I think, was it was so technical with so many bonuses you had to add, a lot of math involved. Yeah. And he's like, I'm tired of doing this. It takes forever to figure out what I need to roll to hit. Marvel, you roll D100, I'm going to look at the chart. Boom, okay, it's in the yellow section. It worked. And that's what I like, is a system that does that. Because it is going to be the story you remember. It's going to be how well the GM plays.
Well, I think that's why I enjoy Shadowrun so much, due to the creativity that it allows.
Right.
Because with Shadowrun being a sci-fi with a mix of fantasy,
mm-hmm.
there's a lot of, I can make this fancy gun, and I can imbue it with magic, or I can come up with some new computer program to hack into systems. And it has this system built in place to literally create whatever you want to create and build, as long as you can justify it.
And that's good. Like I said, it becomes open-ended to say, you do what you want with this. And I do like systems like that. My favorite system, I'm trying to remember that I played under Mutants and Masterminds, but is it the Green Ronin system?
Yes, Green Ronin.
Okay. Which is basically a D20 system. I mean, it had the same 6 stats, and but you use saves instead of hit points. I liked that because it was a point-based system that, much like the hero system or GURPS, you started with effects, and something does damage, and then you added on special effects, like, okay, that damage is fire or lightning or a fist. And you could build, use the various powers, put them together to create whatever effect you want. I felt that system did a really good job of being wide open to whatever you want to create, which is important in a superhero system. And it scaled well in the sense that you could make characters that were on the lower end of power that felt effective and useful and could do things, or on this grand cosmic scale of power, and it felt the same way. And I felt like it did that well.
Had a good balance.
Right. I mean, what I think is important, though, is that to me, what I look for when I say that is that life is just tough. If you are like in Dungeons & Dragons, we look at things like as in level, like your first level, second level, third level, and 20th level. But I look at it from a comic book's perspective. If you're Daredevil or you're Batman, you should not have any influence on any game involving Silver Surfer or Thanos. You're nothing. You're a human.
Right.
And I don't want a game that says, oh, well, you know what? If Daredevil rolls really well and tries something, he knocks out Thanos. To me, my experience with comic book is that's not real. So I don't want them to be close. I want them to be able to assist them to have a spread like that.
I think that was probably one of my problems with D&D and why I stopped playing when we were talking about 3.5 a few minutes ago.
Was the always successful, no matter how crazy it was, try?
Well, we got to a point, we played a game, an epic level game. We started at level 20.
Okay.
And because of all the expansions mm-hmm. that they had done and all the perk system, and
nothing was a challenge.
Wow, okay.
Even everything we ran into, we easily found a way around it by the next week.
Right.
Because of all the different
bonus traits. Well, especially with, you get into the wizards and everything. A level 20 wizard or whatever, they might as well be a god.
Yeah. And, we were facing things from the books that were supposed to be on par with us, and we were just smacking them aside because we always seemed to have that one-trick pony or something that would get us past it.
Interesting.
Now, it may have been because we had a diverse party. We had, a ranger, a paladin, a high-level arcane archer, I think is what it was called.
Okay.
And we just were able to move right through everything. And I was like, oh, this isn't very fun. At all.
Well, for there to be some sense of reward, there's got to be a possibility of loss,
Sure.
I mean, if you know your character can never die, then there's no challenge. It's like you've watched the show Westworld, all these people are doing crazy stuff, taking crazy gunfights or whatever, because they know they can't die. Whereas, if they really were in the West, they wouldn't be challenging every other guy to a gunfight or whatever, because they knew they could die,
Right.
But, so your character's got to believe there is a chance to fail for it to be a challenge, for it to be a thrill. For success to mean anything, failure's got to be an option.
Yeah.
Now, and that's part of providing that sense of possibility of failure. That's part of the DM's responsibility, and that's one of the things you learn in the DM. You've got to make it where and sometimes a character does have to die, or at least come close, And that's a real problem with epic level games, because essentially, you say epic level, but, You're really all on that level. All the villains got to be epic level villains, and
yep.
It's not like you can't be just fighting random Joe Schmo that's a knight. You've got to be fighting the master sorcerer of another dimension. And to get those kind of challenges, so the epic level gaming. And just had to be so absurd to be any kind of a challenge, any kind of fun. And really was a challenging thing to run as a DM.
I think the challenge to me, if you're playing at that level of power, the challenge can't be physical. It can't just be dice rolling against straight
right.
combat. It's got to be how do we do this? How can I
explain? It's got to be a puzzle.
It's got to be a puzzle. It's got to be, how do we do this without magic?
How do we do it without ripping the universe apart?
There's that. It's how do we do this on an emotional level? The goal is not to defeat the dragon, but to convert the dragon to our side. And it becomes a role-playing challenge that maybe is tied in with some action and combat. But if it's just defeat the dragon, yes, you're right. Those things become simpler. I think also there can be a level where there's politics, where it's not just cut and dry us versus them. It's, I think about Game of Thrones, in which all these noble houses have some level of alliance with each other. They have some level of, we just can't go straight at each other's throats. Now, obviously, they did go to war in the show and in the books, but a lot of them...
Spoiler alert, there's a war in Game of Thrones.
For example, I think about...
There may be a big chair in it as well. I'm not real sure about that one.
Oberyn Martell knows in his heart of hearts that the Mountain, and therefore Tywin Lannister, is responsible for his sister's death. They've known that for 20 years. They have not just gone and killed him, even though he wants to. And there's this sense of what he wants to do, the mission is not just get revenge. I want to publicly make them confess. And to me, that's the kind of challenge that has to come out in a higher level game. It's how do you want to do something other than just defeat them. And I think you're right. That's a hard thing as a GM to make that into action, though.
Right, right.
I mean, George R. R. Martin did it, but he's George R. R. Martin.
Well, and that's telling a story is very different than just role-playing and running a game.
True.
Because when you're telling a story or writing a story, all the players cooperate.
Right.
You know, writing or telling a story of a role-playing would be like having to write a choose-your-own-adventure book.
Yes.
Yeah, and I know some people back in the day with the Advance, they like to say, "Oh, well, their characters got these powers. They had a castle, you know. They had an army.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't about them. It was about them having to send out an army, you know. Right. And then while their character goes over here to negotiate, and you have this battle here, so it almost became the game itself could change to role playing, and then you know." An army game, a battle game, I should
right.
say, yeah, as well. So
that's what, going back to where we kind of started. I was asking about the space fighting in Star Wars Fantasy Flight, because I played in a Star Trek the role playing game. Wow, this is back in middle school, so no, high school. This is in late 80s, early 90s, 89 to 91, in which we would play the role playing game. In, you know, if we were on the surface or whatever. But when we got into space battles, we had also had the
Starfleet
battles game. And then we'd follow those rules for that. And that was what I was running. Like, I think that was good to have two systems. One that was designed for playing human characters doing what they do, or, you know, humanoid characters. And a whole separate set of rules for the space battles. And we would train. And it, okay, you know. Like, your character stats didn't matter as much as what you were doing, whatever the space battles rules were.
Well, and I can see that, especially in a Star Trek game, because you are dealing with capital ships the entire time.
Right.
Larger crews with, for Star Wars, you know, you're talking about either you may have one guy that